Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire, who promises not to give any more insight into Suella Braverman's excitement levels.
Sorry about that.
It's all right. Caused quite the stir, Kieran. I was still chuckling. Ali's up in Birmingham at the moment, and I spoke to her about 3 hours later on the phone. She said, "What are you chuckling at?" And eventually I told her, and she went, "Oh my God, you're both in your 50s. Which I've redacted the actual age we are. It's Newsday, Kieran, but we have an interview today. We have an interview with Gareth Coates, who we spoke to last year about the finances of schools football, the most grassroots football of all. We had an update from him that we bring to you at the end of the show. It's not particularly cheery, but it's interesting. And it's very, very worth a listen. In the meantime, Kieran, some big news stories about things that we've been discussing and have been bubbling under. And listeners won't be surprised to learn that the first one is Wigan.
Yes. Wigan have failed to pay wages on four occasions over the course of the last year. This is following the acquisition of the club when it came out of administration. So we always take the view, and I understand it as fans, that new equals better.
Yeah.
And it doesn't. It means different. Mm. And on the consequence, as a consequence of that, the EFL, who have upped their game for quite a certainly for a couple of years now, since Trevor Birch took over as chief exec, they laid down the law. They said that you have a suspended sentence. If you fail to pay the wages on time, then there is a suspended 3 points penalty. That has now been activated. Wigan are at the wrong end of the Championship. Mm. And this could be the difference between staying up and going down. And that's a real shame. And it's happening too often. Derby County, Sheffield Wednesday have both suffered similar fates in recent years. There is a threat over Reading. Paul Ince, I think, has been quoted as saying that he believes that D-Day will be today, i.e. Thursday. Wow. And the reason why he believes that is that today, Thursday, is the deadline by which, if clubs go into administration, the points deduction is applied this season as opposed to next season. But that is impacted by relegation as well. Mm. So it's not good for fans of Wigan. It's made a tough job even harder. Looking at the most recent comments from Sean Maloney, the manager, I got the impression that they were still awaiting wages.
Yeah.
So this is not a cash flow, a short liquidity issue. It's nothing to do with the Queen's Jubilee or foreign banks or some of the other excuses. And I think the problem that Wigan now have is that their credibility, or rather the credibility of the people making the comments, is shot to pieces. Because if you come up with a fairly lame excuse and then the same issue is repeated again and you come up with a different excuse and another different excuse, people begin to go, "Well, I don't think we're not really getting the full story here." So it's a mess. Wigan lost £7 million in getting promoted from League One to the Championship. And if they are relegated, the gap between the Championship and League One, which is significant because in the Championship you get 80% of the money from the EFL TV deal and 80% of the solidarity payments, that's going to be lost. That goes down to 12%. So it's a very significant financial impact, probably in the region of £7 to £8 million is the fall in money. And you've got fewer of the big teams in League One, although there still are Derby, Sheffield Wednesday, Ipswich, Portsmouth. Yeah, there's plenty of big hitters in that division as well.
Sorry, Kim, did you say they lost £7 million being promoted?
Yes, yes. So that was in 21-22. And again, it's part of the insanity of football.
How did that happen?
There's wages, I think wages were £157 for every £100 of income. And right. Then you've got the day-to-day overheads. And it very quickly mounts up. It's an industry which, if I was looking at it from the perspective of a business school, I would say to anybody, just avoid. The risks are high. The rewards are fairly modest unless you do get it right, and unless you're able to persuade another idiot to take the club off you for a much higher fee. And that's what the Glazers are trying to do in the case of Manchester United. Because Manchester United hasn't made money under the Glazers, but they are still hoping to get at least £5 billion. They're aiming for six. Mm-hmm. And the bigger fool theory is in evidence in the football industry.
Well, the one consolation with the dreadful financial situation of football, Kieran, is it has enabled us to do two pods a week to a baffled audience of millions of middle-aged people. Two questions, Kieran, on the back. Well, statements, really, rather, on the back of the Wigan thing. First of all, the chances are they will get relegated. So they'll be losing players, I imagine. But they're going to have a real hard job to replace them. Who in their right mind... Which player and which agent is going to say, yeah, let's go to Wigan. We've had a good offer from them. Wigan can offer them as much as they want in wages. If you're not going to get paid it once every 3 months, why would you take that risk? And the second thing, and I'm not the first person to say this, and we have discussed the fact that the EFL are taking a firmer approach, but it took four times for wages not to be paid before there was a punishment. And like, the first time, we all have cash flow problems at some stage. Once, fine, you can put that down to bad luck. For it to happen four times, Kieran, before any punishment, that doesn't seem as tough as we think the EFL have been recently, does it?
I think that's a valid observation. And I think the problem for the EFL is that they are always looking in the rearview mirror, in the sense that until matters are brought to their attention, that they can't necessarily do things. However, it does now appear that what they are aiming to do is to have what I've referred to as real-time monitoring. Well, people refer to as real-time monitoring of club affairs. So therefore, you instantly know when wages have not been paid. And when we had Mark from
the
National League, he says that's what they do. And Neil Doncaster of the SPFL, he says that's what they do as well. And it's actually a relatively easy policy to adopt. You've got to get the clubs to buy into it, so therefore they've got to vote for it, I guess. And it instantly tells you whether or not some of the key costs are being paid. And in the case of football, we all know that the single biggest expense is that of payroll. And therefore, if payroll doesn't go through, if payments to HMRC don't go through, then you can quickly send in the people whose job it is to investigate. And again, the EFL, they have beefed up their sort of squad of investigative staff who are monitoring the finances of clubs. And the problem they've got is that I think they'd like to extend this even further, but it's got to be approved by clubs, because remember, every pound that you're spending on a financial review panel is a pound which isn't being distributed to clubs. Therefore, it's not going into transfer budgets. It's not going into wages for the players. And if you talk to fans, what do they want most of all? They want more money spent on players and more money spent on transfers.
We know, Kieran, that the words white paper have replaced the words independent regulator at the top of the price of football bingo chart. So let's get white paper out of the way. Now, is there anything in the white paper about real-time monitoring at all levels of football? Because it seems to me it's like the scales fell from my eyes when Mark Ives told us that they have a monthly update from every club so they can keep an eye on situations as they are developing. It seems to be the most simple and obvious way of preventing things like this happen. So is it likely that the EFL and the Premier League would adopt it?
Well, we don't know exactly what the EFL and the Premier League do at present, but certainly this is one thing which would be very easy for the independent regulator to put into operation. For the sake of transparency, I think, you know, I've said I've popped up to somewhere near Parliament on a few occasions over the last 18 months, and given my background, which is an insolvency background, and insolvency is all to do with managing cash, I sort of bang that particular drum, and I'm sure other people do as well, of course. So I would expect that to be one of the tools which would be used by the regulator. It wouldn't be enshrined in legislation as such, but the regulator's powers, I suspect, will be fairly broad and fairly deep, and it would allow them to do what they consider to be appropriate. So this is certainly one way. If you've got any business which has got stresses in relation to cash management, you monitor cash coming both in and out of the business on a daily or weekly basis to ensure that there are no gremlins. And also, you look to see your list of creditors as to when payments are due, and you build, and it's dull stuff. You do budgets and you do cash flow forecasts. This is what any sane business should be doing, but football's not a sane business.
Yeah, Ali would say it's what any sane sole trader should be doing as well, but, you know, that's for a different pod. Can we just clarify as well, Kieran, that when you say you pop up to somewhere near Parliament, you do actually mean Parliament, because, you know, Soho's near Parliament, you know. There's plenty of places in town that are near Parliament. You mean Parliament, Kieran. And talking of the EFL's newfound strength and maturity, they're having a grown-up conversation with the Premier League, hopefully.
Yes, and it would appear, and this is a story which has come through, I think, a few news sources, but it's been most recently on Sky News, that post the white paper, and I can assure you that had there not been a change in Prime Minister and Rishi Sunak taking over from Liz Truss, this would not be the case. This would not have proceeded, because the Truss administration was very opposed to the idea of a football regulator. But post the white paper, the Premier League, which for some reason hadn't been answering calls or putting them onto from the EFL to say, you know, this meeting we're supposed to be having, we're supposed to get, you know, the offer you've been talking about. The Premier League has now effectively made two offers, the first of which was to increase the distribution of monies from Premier League TV deals by £90 million, dropping down into the EFL. I believe that has now gone up to around about £125 million. And now that is half of what the EFL are asking for. That will have strings attached, because the concern from the Premier League, which does have some validity, because when the Premier League agreed to give a percentage of its TV monies to the EFL in the form of solidarity payments, and then the Premier League TV deals in both 2014 and 2017 rocketed up, all of the additional money that was given via that particular route went straight through into wages. So the Premier League saying, well, you know, if we are willing to give up some of our money, but you've got to show the ability to manage that money. And historically, that's not been the case in the Championship. So I think the Premier League will have strings attached. It will say, well, that money has to be allocated for infrastructure projects. If we see wages going up, we will not be very happy. So it's halfway there. I think we will also see a change in the way that the EFL distributes money, because at present it's effectively a flat fee split between the 24 teams in each division. There is talk, at least in the Championship, of that being allocated on a place-by-place basis, although there's a downside to that, because it reinforces existing gaps between clubs. So those appear to be broad positives. Mm. But you then say to yourself, okay, the Premier League is being more generous. And I can understand, you know, you know about some of Steve Parish's comments. Steve Parish says, well, you know, I'm a wealthy man by the standards of the average person, but I'm effectively now giving money to Stoke City, who are owned by Bet365. And yeah, the people at Bet365 earn, you know, factors of tens or hundreds of Steve Parish's wealth. So why am I giving people money to people who are far richer than myself? And you can understand that. So we'll have to see the details there. But if the Premier League is giving more money to the EFL, what else does the Premier League give money to? Well, it gives money to grassroots football in the form of the Football Foundation. Now, the fear of the FA, and this is one of the stories which has popped up in one of the newspapers in the last 24 hours or so, is what happens to that commitment to the Football Foundation? Could it mean that we end up with more money going into the professional game in the lower leagues and less money, therefore, goes to grassroots football? So I think the FA is very concerned that they could be marginalised here. And they could effectively be indirectly paying for some of the additional money going to clubs in the Championship.
Let's not talk about Steve Parish at the moment, Kieran. His ears will be burning enough as it is, to be perfectly honest. He won't be able to put a hat on for a couple of days yet, I imagine. Those of us, Kieran, who like the idea of an independent regulator will say, see, it's already working, because just the mere hint that there may be one in the white paper has got two people talking who haven't talked previously, and that's how the regulator hopefully will work. The regulator won't need to get involved if people are sorting things out like grown-ups. But there is one thing that intrigues me a little bit, Kieran. Some news outlets are using the word negotiate between the Premier League and the EFL. And what I find slightly odd about that is that the EFL have really got nothing to negotiate with, have they? It seems it's all down to the Premier League to make concessions. Is that right?
I think that's absolutely a fair assessment. The Premier League hold all of the cards in relation to this, in the sense that it's the TV deal which they negotiate with their broadcast partners. And again, you know, I've used this analogy before, but the EFL had the opportunity in 1992 to have a joint deal with the Premier League, yeah, in which they were offered 25%, and they turned it down. Now, you could argue that they made a mistake then, and they have to suck it up, and indeed they've had to. Part of the problem in football, if you take a look at the comments which are coming not just from the EFL, but also from Tebas at La Liga, also from the Bundesliga, also some of the people in connection with Serie A as well, is that nobody expected the Premier League to be as successful as it has been. Revenue has increased by 2,600% in 30 years. That is an incredible achievement. Mm. The EFL has done well. But it's not by 2,600%. Compared to the automobile industry or the water industry or whatever you're going to say, the EFL has grown, and it has been successful, and crowds have increased, and it has got good sponsorship deals. But the level of growth has simply been way behind that of the Premier League, and therefore the gap has grown and grown and grown. With hindsight, and we all say with hindsight, things could have been so much better, the EFL should have said yes in 1992. It chose not to do so, and it's been paying the price ever since.
Water industry is doing all right. I watched Paul Whitehouse's brilliant documentary.
That was wonderful and depressing in equal measure.
Yeah, they're making a shed load of money, the water industry, out of pouring shit into our rivers and oceans. That's a brilliant business plan. This next question, the story, Kieran, rather, it's a shame it didn't happen a week or two ago, because we could have put it to Mark Ives, but some interesting news for players in the non-league.
Yes, this is very disturbing. An email which has come to me Yeah, as we know, we know some players. We know some players at different forms of the ground. There are changes to contracts for players in the National League. Under the current position, if a player is injured playing football in the National League, then the player continues to be paid. But under the new contract, you will only get your full wages for 12 weeks if you're a National League player, or for 6 weeks if you're below the National League National Division, i.e. the National League South or National League North. And if you're still injured, then you drop down to statutory sick pay. Now, statutory sick pay is £99.35 per week. Now, we are talking about an industry which is involving elite athletes. We are talking about an industry which is a contact sport, and we are talking about an industry in which it is not unusual for players to have long-term injuries. Nobody goes into a tackle with the intention of being injured. Nobody is putting 100%, chasing that ball in the 93rd minute of a game with the thought that my hamstring could go. But you know, that is always a risk as far as the game is concerned. And that risk is borne by the athlete in terms of, you know, they can't play in the remaining matches. But they've always had that safety net, knowing that if I try to win that ball and something bad happens, I've got the security of a contract which lasts me until, and I think we've said in the past, isn't it, it's the 30th of April.
Yeah.
In the National League, when they tend to have 10-month contracts. This, for me, is very disturbing because it is making things difficult for players. What also will be the case is if a player signs one of these new contracts, the contract can be terminated with 3 months' notice if, in the opinion of a club-instructed medic, so not an independent doctor, the player is unable through injury or illness to play for a period of 4 months. So in what is a precarious career, because the average length of career of a professional footballer is 7 years, and people say, well, hold on, you know, such and such has played for 15 years and 20 years and so on. But, yeah, I'd point them to Enoch Mwepu, who Brighton signed 15 months ago, who has had to retire at the age of 24.
Yeah.
And there are other players who simply, they drop out of the game at a much earlier stage, but we don't get to hear about them because they don't tend to be high profile. This is the National League where the wages are not big to begin with. We hear about the stories of how much Wrexham are playing, but Wrexham are outliers.
Yeah.
So I find this very worrying indeed. I appreciate that clubs are losing money in the National League, but at the same time, this is not looking after their staff, and the players have to, I mean, to be fair, the players have to opt in to these contracts. But of course, the threat is if you don't opt in to the contract, then you don't get offered the contract in the first place.
Yeah, if Mark Ives, the general manager of the National League, is listening to this, and he is, so I know he does, I'd be really interested in a response because I'm quite baffled by this story, Keir. I mean, first of all, 30, 40 years ago, it wouldn't have been an issue because 30, 40 years ago, players in the Southern League or the Northern Premier League at most were semi-professional, and even that was unusual. They would have had a day job, most of them, and played football midweek and Saturday for their non-league club. And they probably would have been glad to get statutory sick pay if they were injured. But now they're all professional, Kieran. They're professional athletes on professional contracts. But what baffles me most, with my ex-human resources hat on, is that you can't make major changes like this to a contract system. And the contract system in this country is all over the place. But you can't make major changes to contracts without negotiation and consultation. And this seems to have come out of nowhere, absolutely without negotiation or consultation. So again, if any of our legal friends are listening to this, I'd be really interested to hear what they've got to say as well, because, you know, we always try and say there's two sides to every story, but the side that we're hearing about is wrong. I'll try to think of a grown-up, clever legal word for it, but it's just wrong, essentially. Talking of wrong, Kieran, normally that's the word that follows most mentions of FIFA. But for once, and there could well be a caveat coming up, but it seems like FIFA have done the right thing for once.
Yes, FIFA have tripled the money for the 2023 Women's World Cup, which is taking place in Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah.
The competition, first of all, has been expanded from 24 to 32 national teams, which I think is encouraging. I think it's indicative of an increase in the standard of the overall product. So there's now going to be $152 million worth of prize money, funding for clubs, i.e., you know, the cost of the teams going to training camps, pre-tournament, the cost of accommodation, flights, and so on, and also payments to clubs because the clubs are effectively losing their employees for a period of a month or so. That compares to $649 million for the 22 World Cup that we've just had. So it is substantially less, but I think it is heading in the right direction. Gianni Infantino, who, it has to be said, has come in from a fair amount of stick from us, has said that for the 2026 and 2027 World Cups, the Men's World Cup in 26 and the Women's World Cup in 27, that he wants to see equality in terms of the prize money. But I think he's also acknowledged that outputs, i.e. the money paid out by FIFA, are to a large extent determined by inputs, which is the revenue generated through sponsorship deals and broadcasting. And he has had a bit of an aim at broadcasters and sponsors, which I find rather strange because they are the biggest contributors to FIFA, and he's moaning at them that they're not giving him enough money. It's a tricky one because there is a case for saying that you should always try to match your inputs and outputs in every business. But there's also a case for saying, in respect of the Women's World Cup, this is the pinnacle of the women's professional game. It is also representing your country, which is the pinnacle for an individual player's career. And it does attract a different audience. There isn't, if you drew a Venn diagram of the people that watch women's football and the people that watch men's football, there's not a complete overlap, and that's right and proper. I think anybody that's attended women's games will know that to be the case. It's in my opinion a more inclusive, a more diverse audience, and so on. But fair play to FIFA for tripling the money. I think Gianni Infantino is trying to put the thumb screws on the broadcasters, but the broadcasters will say, well, the amount of money that we can afford to bid for the tournament is to a large extent determined by viewing figures, and because viewing figures means higher viewing figures equals higher advertising income, which allows us to pay more. So I think there's a lot of stakeholders involved here in terms of the future financing of the women's game. We also had an open letter going from Lewis Football Club the last week talking about the differences in prize money between the women's FA Cup and the men's FA Cup. Yeah. I think Lewis got 46,000. Yeah. They played against Manchester United in the quarterfinal.
Well, we spoke
of the women's competition.
We spoke to Sophia, didn't we, from Clapton Community FC about this very issue last year.
Exactly, exactly. And Clapton FC, they lost money going to an FA Cup game.
Yeah.
Is there a case for equality? I think that there is a sort of case, but again, I think we've got to be a little bit cautious here. Ultimately, again, from the perspective of the broadcasters, and they are the people that are handing over the checks, they will say, we will quite happily give far more money for the deal if we think we're going to have much higher viewing figures. And if the viewing figures aren't there, we don't have the resources. But the FA is in a position to say, well, perhaps there could be a little bit of a greater switch from the men's game to the women's game with a view to narrowing the gap. And that should be the way forwards. And for ideally, as audiences continue to increase. And the women's game is a startup. The women's game, realistically, in this country, has only been going for, you know, for a handful of years as such in terms of the WSL and so on.
Fair point.
And therefore, it's coming from a completely different place. But it's a growth industry. And in order to encourage that growth further, I think the FA could perhaps be a wee bit more generous.
But, Kieran, but, and I'm aware that somewhere out there listening to this is an American version of you chuckling away at the word but there's always a but when it comes to FIFA, because FIFA, I mean, quite rightly, Infantino got a deal of credit for announcing that the prize money for the 2027 Women's World Cup will equal that of the men's. But this is the same Gianni Infantino who invited Visit Saudi, the tourist board of the Saudi government, to sponsor the Women's World Cup in 2023, and then made a really petulant speech last week because the Australian FA and the New Zealand FA kicked up such a fuss that their offer to sponsorship has been withdrawn. And he does the trembling bottom lip really well, but said last week, I don't understand this. We tried to do a good thing. I don't understand why the Australian FA are unhappy about this when the Australian government is investing lots of money in Saudi Arabia and all sorts of Saudi Arabian businesses. And the Australian FA had to point out that the FA and the government are very different because if they weren't, FIFA would sanction us because we're not allowed to have government interference. So it's just he's that baffled look he does. We thought it'd be a really good idea to ask a repressive regime where women don't have the same rights as men to sponsor the Women's World Cup. And then he can't understand why women in Australia and New Zealand are not happy about it. There's always a but with FIFA, Kieran. That's the trouble.
There is.
You mentioned earlier, Kieran, that new isn't always better. And the latest club who may be discovering that is another one we've discussed very recently. It's one of those EFL clubs that are in a bit of trouble.
Yes, this is Huddersfield Town. Now, Huddersfield have put out effectively an announcement to say that they have they've appointed turnaround specialists, DA Capital, to try to find a bidder for the club with a view to selling it. And handing over control from Dean Hoyle, who owns 25% of the club. He sold the other 75% to a guy called, I think it's Phil Hodgkinson, whose own businesses have not worked out. And that's always a risk in relation to any football club. And it said in the press release, you know, we don't want to go into administration. And that's fully understandable because if you go into administration by Thursday, then you're potentially going to get a 15-point penalty, which could be applied either this season or next season, depending upon the number of points you earn by the end of the year. So it could apply at the start of 23-24. Now, the choices are that if DA Capital managed to find somebody willing to buy the shares in Huddersfield Town Association Football Club, then the people that buy those shares inherit everything. So they inherit the stadium, they inherit the players' contracts, they inherit the money which is due on player sales, but they also inherit the liabilities. Now, we've not seen Huddersfield's 2022 accounts, so there is a degree of uncertainty here. But looking at their 21 accounts, they had £43 million of debt. So you'd have to deal with that as well. If Huddersfield Town do go into administration, then the new owners would, again, buy the stadium. They would buy they'd acquire the players' contracts and everything else, but they would not take over the debts. So it's effectively putting a price on that level of debt. If Huddersfield get a 15-point penalty this season, which I'm hoping they don't, go into administration, then they are, realistically, they're going to be relegated. And we've made reference to Reading. We've made reference to Wigan. You know, potentially, you could end up with three clubs going down, all on the back of a contributory factor of having a points deduction. Football is supposed to be played on grass.
Yes, I agree, Kieran, but I'm at the stage where I'm going through the club record books myself now to find three clubs in the Premier League who might need a points deduction before the end of the season. I'm intrigued by DA Capital, Kieran, and the idea of turnaround specialists. Are they the same sort of people that would also act as administrators, or are they specialists simply? You simply go to these people and say, we need new owners, can you find them? So they're like headhunters in a way, are they?
Sort of. I mean, what quite often happens in relation to the corporate world is that the investigating firms will have an insolvency arm as well.
Right.
They go in, they check the books, they try to put together a form of a sales brochure to persuade other people. Now, as far as Huddersfield are concerned, I know that there is a potential offer coming here. There's a story from a guy called Adam Williams. I know Adam quite well, who is a football journalist. He seems to think that there is a chance of a local group coming in. But if that isn't the case, then you do wonder how Huddersfield are going to pay the bills, because they're no longer in receipt of parachute payments, and their majority shareholder doesn't appear to have cashed to fund the business.
Is there a risk, Kieran, so if a club turns to someone like DA Capital to look at the books and find a buyer? Is there a risk that the people at DA Capital say, actually, we've looked at the books and you need our administration branch? Could that happen?
That will be one of the considerations.
Right, okay.
They will say, this is what we think you should be able to sell the club for. Now, then Huddersfield will say, well, on that basis, do we satisfy the EFL rules in relation to 100% of football creditors being paid and 25% of everybody else being paid? That would be a consideration, because when you exit administration, there is always the danger of a second points deduction if you can't afford to pay that. So, yes, all eventualities will have been considered in terms of, this is what we think are realistic prices, these are the debts we're inheriting, and then you start to crunch to see just how bad it could be, given the three eventualities, which is A, sell Huddersfield Town now, new owner inherits all the debts, B, put the club into administration, sell it as a pre-pack with enough money to pay off the creditors to just have 1 point deduction, or nuclear situation, worst possible situation, is where club goes into administration, exits administration, and then gets a further points deduction.
Oh, it seems like an awful long time since that wonderful season they had in the Premier League, doesn't it? This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. We are living in an era of information overload, and we have more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? If you're in Notion, you put that knowledge to work.
It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but getting inspired. And all I can say on a personal level, as for somebody whose life is quite chaotic, and I'm writing pieces for government and newspapers and media content, I've got my university commitments and I'm supposed to be writing a book, I use Notion all the time because it brings order into chaos.
Well, if you need order brought to your chaos, you can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning your ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
We've been talking recently, Kieran, about two Uniteds, united by worried fans, amongst anything else. So what is the latest from Sheffield and Southend?
Right. In terms of Sheffield United, first of all, congratulations getting to the FA Cup semi-final. We look forward to seeing you at Wembley in the final.
I'm choosing to ignore that, Kieran. I'm just going to let that go, especially in the light of the next news story we have coming up, which is about my perfect club. Anyway, carry on.
So, the Nigerian businessman who has been linked with an acquisition, he has upped his game by appointing Deloitte, the big accountancy firm, to effectively to audit his books, with a view to increasing the degree of credibility that he has. The EFL have been asking additional questions, requesting additional information with regards to his financial background. Remember, we did mention that he has had issues with regards to unpaid payments, I think county court judgments for non-payment of rent and so on, which is something you would not expect to be the case with a successful billionaire. So that appears to be nudging forwards, and then sort of some of the great things about football, and these are even being reported. You know, he's liked a tweet put out by Sheffield United in terms of them getting to the FA Cup semi-final, and he's following a certain person who's connected to Sheffield United on Instagram. What can we read from this? So there's clearly a campaign that he's adopting of trying to increase his links to the club through other means than actually buying the shares. So that's where we are in respect of Sheffield United. Now, in respect of Southend United, our very good friend, Ron Martin, the man who has, I think it's fair to say, upset the Southend United fan base a tad, has formally said that the club is up for sale.
Oh, okay.
He is using an organisation called General Sports Worldwide. Now, General Sports Worldwide is controlled by Andy Appleby, who has been working in the world of football for many years. He used to be the owner of Derby. I think he might have been the guy that sold Derby County to Mel Morris. And also Jez Moxie. Now, Jez Moxie has been an executive with the likes of Stoke, Wolves, Norwich, Burton Albion, and so on. But he's also a director of the EFL. And this is where I find myself slightly uncomfortable. Now, I fully admit that Southend United is not part of the EFL these days, you know, since being relegated to the National League. But why is a director of the EFL involved in selling a former member of the EFL? Would he also be involved in, because he says that effectively a General Sports Worldwide, it sees itself as an estate agent for football clubs, and its job is to sift through the tire kickers and the lunatics and the naysayers who do get connected with potential bids. I think there is a case for saying that if we were talking about an EFL club, I personally would feel very uncomfortable about a director of the EFL who potentially has access, therefore, to information held by the EFL being involved in the sale. So I think that there's a potential conflict of interest there, and he is, I believe, still involved with another club. There's a case for saying surely EFL directors should be a bit like Caesar's wife. If you're going to be involved in the industry at that level, then there has to be a case for severing your involvement in other businesses to which you might have historically been associated.
Well, Trevor, if you're listening, and we know you are, give Kieran a call. We'd love to hear your... on line four, we have Trevor from the EFL. Southend fans won't have heard the last bit of that because they would have been out celebrating the minute you said Ron Martin has formally said the club is up for sale. It says here, Kieran, I don't know why, on a news pod about football finances, but it says here Brighton's latest accounts are out. I imagine they were came in a folder made of vegan leather embossed with organic gold, written in saffron ink, and probably went, everything's brilliant, not like the rest of you losers. So can we move on to the next story? Or is there anything you need to add to that? Is there anything in there about the miracle that you didn't get drawn against Sheffield United? You actually got a Premier League club to play in the semi-final. Anyway, anything in that story, Kieran? Anything?
Record revenues, record profits, record player sales, all on... having the second lowest wage bill in the Premier League. Apart from that, nothing to report.
I'm delighted for you, Kieran. Chelsea fans could be moving home, Kieran.
Yes. It looks as if Todd Bowley is considering doing one of two things in relation to Chelsea. It could be building a new stadium on the current land print that Chelsea have. There has been talk about moving the stadium or moving the pitch 90 degrees because I think Chelsea potentially have access to buying some land, which would mean that the sort of the main stand would have to be effectively relocated by a quarter. And there have been also talks about buying another plot of land and utilising that. In terms of the cost, I think if it was £1 billion, that would be a bargain. It's more likely to be closer to £2 billion. If Chelsea are going to aim for a stadium similar in size to that of Spurs, Arsenal, West Ham, and of course, you know, Chelsea could easily fill a 60,000 stadium on a regular basis. So... that is the latest talk. And the reason for that is if you take a look at Chelsea's accounts, in terms of ticket sales, because Stamford Bridge is 41,000, it generates match day income. And these figures are sort of from the pre-COVID account, so therefore they're not distorted by COVID. Match day income was 67 million. Now you've got Manchester United at 110. We've got Spurs who could easily get to 110. Arsenal, if they qualify for the Champions League, they could get 110 as well. So that would mean if Chelsea stay where they are, then they're going to start each season on minus 30 to 40 million pounds in respect of the other major clubs in the Big Six. And with a likely change, I think it is expected that the Premier League will adopt new financial rules to replace financial fair play, to bring themselves broadly in line with what we have at UEFA. So therefore, some form of wage control. And if that wage control is linked to income, if you start off with £40 million worth less of match day income, then let's say it's 70%, you've automatically got a £30 million differential when it comes through to wages. So that's a quite a bit of catch-up for Chelsea. They're trying to attract better players, just like all clubs are. But if they are limited in what they can pay out in wages due to the size of the stadium, then this is one area that they need to address. And as well as being saying something nice about Gianni Infantino, and I think it must be living an out-of-body experience here, I've also got to say something nice about Ken Bates in the sense that he set up the Chelsea, you know, he was involved with the creation of the Chelsea pitch owners, which for people not familiar with the story, effectively divided the pitch into one-yard squares, or it could be 1 metre, I'm not sure whether it was pre-decimal or not, and... every one of those shares is owned by somebody different, because you're not allowed, I don't think you're allowed to own more than 10 shares in Chelsea pitch owners, or you're not allowed to have more than 10 votes. So there are many, many shares in Chelsea pitch owners, and Chelsea pitch owners have ownership of the Chelsea Football Club name, I think, but they certainly have ownership of a lot of the intellectual property and effectively the pitch itself. So this is to prevent somebody coming in to Chelsea saying, blimey O'Reilly, this is a piece of real estate that is worth an absolute fortune if it was converted into offices or flats. So it was done from a protectionist point of view, and it was a bit of foresight by Ken Bates, for which I think he deserves a lot of credit, and I've said it. That I think the approval of Chelsea pitch owners would be required as well. So I think a persuasive case by the Todd Bowley Group would therefore be required.
Everything I've read about Ken Bates, Kieran, would indicate it definitely will be yards. I don't think Ken Bates would have gone along with his fancy foreign measurements. Talking of real estate, Kieran, is there any indication of where Chelsea are looking? Because if they're looking round the corner in terms of cost and availability, that's going to be difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, I think there was some talk about Earl's Court, but I don't know enough about London to know whether it's big enough or whether it would be appropriate. I think in an ideal world, they would still want to be where they are. And the problem that they've got is, you say, it's a very expensive area, and therefore those people who are living in apartments, in private accommodation, in office accommodation, they tend to be very wealthy people. And the last thing that those very wealthy people want is a 2 or 3 year building project taking place. And then you've got issues of, could there be light pollution issues to have to deal with? These people tend to have very expensive lawyers who will be putting up objections. So I think this could be a really tough challenge for the Chelsea owners.
We still have a couple of stories, Kieran, before our interview, so let's, I think, probably try and rattle through them a little bit. For some reason, nothing bemuses and amuses football fans more than a match being abandoned, as we saw at the weekend. Any financial implications for Rotherham and Cardiff? Because like the rest of the nation, I thought it was fantastic seeing a referee trying to bounce a ball in the free foot, basically in the shallow end of the ground, while angry Cardiff fans were demanding that they be given the game. So it's so rare to see it in modern football. It does beg the question of whether there will be some financial ramifications.
I'm not sure on this one. I don't know whether Rotherham will have to reimburse Cardiff for their travel expenses. But that's about as far as it's likely to go. Because the match lasted more than 45 minutes, I don't think you're entitled to a refund as a fan, although it could be given on a discretionary basis. Clearly, if you're a season ticket holder at Rotherham, that should not be a problem for you. It's wonderful to see those huge brooms as well. And you've got people from Cardiff saying, well, they're doing an absolutely useless job, and you've got the people from Rotherham. Well, we're doing as well as we can, you know, from a dinghy. Yeah, you try sweeping from a dinghy. It's not easy at all. But it's
there was one brilliant photograph on social media of a steward leaning on his broom, which was then matched by Rotherham fans photographing the same steward saying he's doing that because he's just exhausted himself. A photograph of him. I mean, Kieran, I don't see how Rotherham can be blamed financially for a deluge that was so bad. At one stage, it looked like the animals were going to be entering the stadium two by two. So it seems a bit unfair to say, well, they've got to reimburse Cardiff for the travel.
Yes, I think what's got to be the case is, have Rotherham taken all appropriate steps to try to ensure that the match was able to continue? By the looks of it, they did, and therefore there should be no further repercussions. But without seeing the minutiae of the EFL handbook, and I must confess, because we've had so many stories, my handbook is never far away, but I've not had a chance to thumb through it this morning.
Yeah, the way you say thumb through it, Kieran, it all sounds so sinister. I don't know why. Kirill Louis-Dreyfus, Kieran, is only young, but he already seems like an old friend.
Yes, yeah, but by gum, I'd like to be a millionaire at his age, or billionaire at his age. Well, millionaire, I'd be happy to be a millionaire. I'm not greedy.
Any age, Kieran.
Yes. He acquired Sunderland from Stuart Donald a year or two ago, and he has increased his investment, as has one Sartori. I think the big issue here is that Stuart Donald has reduced his investment in Sunderland to 9%. And if you own less than 10% in a club, it does mean that you are effectively free to invest in other clubs. So Stuart Donald will have received some money from the sale of his shares. There'll be no money going to Sunderland itself. Kirill Louis-Dreyfus did originally have 51%, and that's the key number, because once you own 51% of the shares, especially as they're all equal voting shares, it's not like Manchester United and the Glazers, once you own 51% of the shares, that means that you have control over the votes. You can choose the directors, you can choose the manager, you have a lot of say over what's happening on a day-to-day basis. So it looks as if Stuart Donald is cashing out. He said that he's kept his 9% because he loves Sunderland. For anybody that has watched Sunderland Till I Die, which if you've not, I thoroughly recommend as a piece of popcorn munching theatre. It's a wonderful experience. He's a different type of owner. I don't think he's evil. I'm not sure that his decision making is necessarily great. And I'm trying here to avoid another long email from his chum, Charlie Methven, with regards to this. But in my view, he's the reason why he's decided to hold on to some of his shares is that should Sunderland be promoted to the Premier League, and they're having a pretty decent season, the value of those shares will go up substantially, and therefore he could sell out his final 9% and get a much higher fee. So sometimes you do things for love, sometimes you do things for money. Stuart Donald is claiming he's holding on his 9% for love, but I'm not convinced of that myself.
I'm just laughing at the idea, Kieran, that Stuart Donald's agent says to him, mate, Stuart, this show we're doing, we need a good quote for the poster. So far, the best we can come up with is, I don't think he's evil, Kieran Maguire. Kieran, you know, we've already mentioned the 2026 World Cup final. And this last story, yes. I think it's only March. This is definitely a contender for my favourite story of the year. You know how much I hate spring and summer. Yesterday I was getting quite miserable at the idea that sunshine and summer was coming, but this story actually ironically put a little spring in my step.
Yes, the 2026 World Cup final was due to take place in Los Angeles at the SoFi Stadium. But somebody from FIFA has popped down there with a very long measuring tape and go, sorry, mate, can't do this. The ground's too narrow. So they're going to have to go and find somewhere else. And this stadium, I think, by all accounts, cost an absolute fortune to put together. You know, it wasn't designed for soccer. It's a multifunction stadium aimed at NFL and so on. But where the 2026 World Cup is going to take place is probably going to have to be somewhere else. So hats off to Jobsworths everywhere who've pointed this out to FIFA. And at least we know well in advance, because I'm hoping to do that World Cup and with some of my mates, and I think we have to go and make sure we've got a ticket for the final anyway. The chances are fairly remote, but we're not going to be booking into LA for the final day.
There may be other stadium in LA, Kieran, who knows, but I just love the idea of when the stadium's open, the general manager saying to the architect, should I be able to touch both touch lines at the same time? As it seems, it just seems a little bit too. Also, the fact that FIFA have got somebody whose job it is to just go and check it's wide enough for the World Cup fight. It must be, boss. Gianni, come on now. I know we waste money flying all over the world for junkets. Let's not send me to Los Angeles to measure the pitch. And Gianni will be back home in Switzerland now again. I told you. That's why I'm the uncontested elected head of FIFA forever. Last year, Kieran, we spoke to Gareth Coates from the Middlesex Schools Football Association about some of the difficulties of football at the lowest of grassroots level. And he asked us to talk to him again this week, just to catch up with what's been happening in his life and in the life of Middlesex Schools Football Association. Now, Gareth, the last time we spoke, you told us you were planning to step down from your role. So what happened?
The simple answer is I couldn't find anyone to replace me.
Oh, really?
I didn't want to walk away and leave Middlesex Schools FA in the lurch. And at the time I was planning to step away last season, there was a project going on with the English Schools FA around bringing in a standard code of rules for competitions at county level and upwards, which I was asked to be a part of. Hmm. And I wanted to try and see that through if I possibly could. So I did say I would give it another year. I really am stepping down at the end of this season because we've got somebody in place now who I'm starting to train up and prepare a handover to. But it was important to me that after all the work we'd done to build Middlesex Schools FA back up, especially after the pandemic, that it didn't just fall down for the lack of somebody to deal with the correspondence and the paperwork.
Well, it's nice to know you're irreplaceable. If Michael McIntyre became available, I'd be dropped like a hot brick from this pod. I'm intrigued to hear you talk about the continuance of Middlesex Schools FA, because that last time we spoke, Kieran and I were united in our admiration for your commitment to and passion for representative inter-county school football. But something has changed since then, hasn't it?
Yes. We have found, we've reached the conclusion very sadly that inter-county representative football is not sustainable in Middlesex. I did some spreadsheet work and I calculated that 89% of our primary income, and our primary income is affiliation and cup entry fees from schools who play in our inter-schools cups, has been spent this season on the rep teams, which doesn't leave a lot left to pay for the 13 cup finals we need to stage, and the medals associated with those cups, and so on and so forth. And the other major issue that we have is that we simply don't have the volunteers to make sure that those teams are run as professionally as we would like. So the burden falls on myself and on my representative football coordinator, who is a parent. She's a volunteer. She's done a fantastic job. But at times this season in particular, it's been like nailing jelly to a wall. So as a management committee, we have reluctantly concluded that the best thing to do would be to stop fielding county teams and to focus our efforts on our inter-school cups and other competitions and provide football for a much broader group of children than would be the case if we focused on the elite.
Are you the only county to make this decision, Gareth?
We are the only one that has made this decision this season and has announced it so publicly. But there are 8 of the 44 counties affiliated to English Schools FA who don't field representative teams. And 2 of those are in the Southeast region that we compete in, specifically Buckinghamshire and Cambridgeshire. But there are others dotted around the country. And after we made the announcement on our website and on our Twitter feed, we did hear from other counties saying that they feared that they weren't a million miles away from the point that we've reached. To give you an example, Bedfordshire Schools FA did some crowdfunding to try and raise £1,500 for new playing kit, and they've raised less than £400. So the problem that all schools FAs have at county level is that if they don't get the support, and it's not just financial, as I say, but if people don't support these teams, they cannot function. And unfortunately, that's where we're at in Middlesex.
You say, Gareth, that it's not just financial. It occurs to me, with all due respect, I mean, I know 13 sets of medals is quite expensive, but in the scheme of things, in comparison to the money there is in a game, it doesn't strike me that it would need that much money to continue. So what sort of funds would it have taken for you to continue? And did you look to source them from outside, from sponsorship, for example, rather than, say, parents' fees or whatever?
We would dearly love to go and get sponsors, but there are a couple of fairly major challenges in that respect. One is that the economy's in the toilet and everybody's struggling.
Yeah.
And potential sponsors want a return on their investment. And between them, our five teams this season have only played 23 matches because of the way rep football is structured. Unless you are extremely successful, you only play a small number of games because you play in your regional league, and that starts with a group stage and then goes into semi-finals and a final. And then you have the National Cup, which is like any cup, lose and you're out. And unfortunately, two of the three rep teams that we entered into the National Cups this season were eliminated at the first stage. So it's very difficult for us to justify to a sponsor why they should put money into these teams, because we can't guarantee them a specific level of exposure.
Right.
And the other problem that we have, and this goes far beyond the financial, is that we simply don't have the volunteers to go out and get sponsorship.
Okay.
As an example, I actually live 200 miles from Middlesex.
Right.
I moved away 7 years ago. Yeah. I live just outside Liverpool. But I keep doing this because I want the activities of the school's FA, its 90-year history, to continue, and because I love the game of football. And, you know, the 13 cups we run are managed by teachers who are doing that around their day jobs. They don't have time to go on, knock on the door of Company X and say, we've got these teams, can you sponsor us, please? Now, some of our counterparts in other counties don't have that problem. They do have sponsorship, but it isn't enough on its own to cover the costs of running these teams. Mm. You have to bear in mind that we run, we have to hire the venues, we have to pay the match officials, we have to provide catering for the players after the game, and so on and so forth. And some counties are quite successful, and they generate, you know, maybe four figures a year in sponsorship. Mm. But if they're spending five figures on running their teams, then all that's doing is offsetting that cost, and they have to find the money from somewhere else. And that's what we've been doing for a long time.
In the unlikely event, Gareth, that I was able to write out a blank check, what sort of figure would you be looking at for you to be able to continue to do this?
Well, it's very difficult to say, because you don't know how successful any given age group is going to be.
Ah, okay.
But what I would say is that if there was a guaranteed £10,000 a season in funding, our rep teams could continue in the way that they have. Now, we have run on the proverbial shoestring for a long time, and there are other counties that do a lot more than we do, but they spend a lot more money to do it. So if you look at the Kent Schools FA, which is a charity, and you look at the figures they've spent, but the money they generate in return to cover that, that's how they do it. And they do put things on outside the traditional school's football calendar, which I presume parents are contributing towards, and that helps pay for it. Whereas we've taken the very traditional position in Middlesex that playing for your county is an honour and it shouldn't cost you anything. So we've never asked parents for a penny. I don't know how common that model is in our counterparts around the country anymore because of the way the game has changed. But it's what we've always tried to do in Middlesex. We've tried to make playing for your county the pinnacle of your school's football career, and therefore not put a cost on it.
Interesting to hear you say that Kent Schools FA are a charity. Gareth, is that unusual then? Is Middlesex not a charity?
We're not. We're an unincorporated association.
Okay.
Because we are so small terms of finances it just isn't worth the hoops that you have to jump through. Kent's income is 14 times higher than ours.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But their expenditure is also significantly higher than ours. And, you know, my colleagues in Kent It's a much bigger county than us. They are very good at what they do, and they have a very strong culture of representative football, not just at county level, but at district level as well. And they run a huge number of competitions. So I have massive respect for my friends in Kent. But they have a bigger base from which to work than we do.
Yeah. I'm going to ask this next question in two parts, Gareth, because I mean, back in the day, when Kieran and I were growing up, schoolboy football would feel Wembley. Is there perhaps just not the interest there used to be in schools football now? And is that the second part of the question? Is that probably because schoolboy football is no longer one of the routes to a professional career the way it could be when kids like Terry Venables and Bobby Charlton were filling Wembley?
Well, I'll answer the second part of that question first, Kevin.
Yeah.
It is still possible to go from the national schoolboys team to a professional contract. Chris Smalling did it not so long ago. And again, he's a boy from Kent, and he went from
Maidstone,
playing for Kent Schools FA and Maidstone United. And now I think he's playing in Serie A for Roma. So it can be done. But the problem that you have these days, to go back to the first part of your question, is that it's a lot easier to watch a lot more football than it used to be. And there are so many more competitions now. There are so many more games. I mean, if you look at the Champions League compared to the old European Cup, if you look at how many games are televised these days compared to the fact that when the schoolboy internationals were at Wembley, you got the FA Cup final and the home international championship, and that was about it in most seasons. You know, when the Premier League has become this all-encompassing product, this almost a branch of show business, then it does absolutely dilute the interest in things like the England Schools FA national teams. I mean, you talk about them filling Wembley. I looked it up. The England versus Scotland game last season was played at Spennymoor Town and attracted a crowd just over 1,000.
Wow.
So it's absolutely true that there is less interest in schools representative football than there used to be. But that is equally true of lots of the smaller forms of the game, if you like.
You mentioned Chris Smalling. The problem is, I don't know how old Chris Smalling is, but he must be closer to 30 than to 20. And the thing is that every one of the 92 professional clubs will have found out, for the most part, about the good kids in their area before they reach the level you're talking about. It must be even more frustrating for you, Gareth, because since the white paper, all of us have been talking about the importance of grassroots football, and you're losing a level of important football for the want of £10,000. I mean, that's galling, isn't it?
It's frustrating, and it is painful, because this is an aspect of schools football that dates back nearly 100 years. But it's a pragmatic decision from our point of view. We want to safeguard the county cups that we run. We're very proud in Middlesex that we have an equal offer for boys and girls from under 13 right the way through to sixth form. You know, there's no gap there. There is a boys cup and a girls cup at every age group from under 13 up to upper sixth form in our county. That's something we've done a lot of work on. And that is, I think, worth protecting. And that's a different form of grassroots football. It gets to more children. You know, we have 74 schools in membership this season. We hope to grow that, because that's nowhere near all the schools in our eight boroughs. I think it's about a third. If we can grow that, and we can get more kids playing, and I'm not just talking boys, I'm talking girls as well, then when we can do that by eliminating a cost for what is nominally an elite level team that impacts on maybe 150 kids a season, once we've selected the squads from the trials, then I think that's a price worth paying in the longer term. It is sad. It is painful. It's not something that we wanted to do, but we want to make sure that the Middlesex Schools FA is still here in another 90 years and is offering as many kids as possible the opportunity to play football.
Which is absolutely right, but it still leaves 150 kids who are decent footballers at a grassroots level with a step missing, if you like. I'm pleased to hear you talk about girls as well, Gareth, because this is what's confusing me the most about what you're telling me, because the FA and Barclays, neither of whom are short of a few bob, are currently running a TV campaign talking about ensuring that all girls get access to schools football, which is, and it's a shameful disgrace that they don't currently. But now you're telling us that there's a whole level of school child football that's in danger of disappearing altogether. It doesn't make sense to me, Gareth.
Well, I think the FA and Barclays would look at our competition model and say that that is what they're trying to promote, right. Because representative football is important. It is a stepping stone, not just into the professional game, but into things like college scholarships in the USA and to all sorts of opportunities for young people.
Well, also,
so I don't want to downplay its importance.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Gareth, as well, but it's not just opportunity. It's fitness, it's health, it's social, it's mixing with all sorts of other people. It's important of itself. It's not just important as a stepping stone. It's just important for these kids, full stop.
No, it is. It absolutely is. And that's why when we announced we were mothballing the representative teams, it caught the imagination of the football public. But the FA are not interested in representative football unless it's at the very, very top level.
Right.
And it has three lions on the shirt. And I think that's a little bit short-sighted. For the girls' representative teams in particular, we have massive problems just getting the games on.
Yeah.
Because the FA has created an elite player pathway for girls' teams where there is a network of regional talent clubs who are FA licensed and play in specific competitions. And the only time those regional talent clubs are obliged to release girls for their counties is on the second Saturday of every month. Mm. And in order to get that release, we have to call the players up at least 14 days beforehand, which is an extra additional administrative burden for our volunteers to bear. Because, you know, if they've got a day job and they send the email a day late and then the club says, well, no, you're inside the 14 days, we're going to keep girl X, right, and we're going to play and you can't have her, then that then weakens the county team who are trying to select the player. I'm not saying that that happens as a matter of routine, but I know it does happen. And I know that even when players are called up in accordance with the procedures, they are occasionally encouraged not to answer the call and to make themselves unavailable for their counties. So it's a real struggle just to get the teams on the pitch at times. And that's because, with girls' football in particular, the FA is very, very keen to have a pathway that leads to their teams rather than to schools' teams. And I can understand that. And they've done some fantastic work in girls' football and women's football. And the success of the Lionesses at the Euros last year is a testament to that. But Chloe Kelly, who scored the winning goal in the final, is a former Middlesex Schools representative player. She wasn't in the RTC. She was initially, she was in our rep sites, and she progressed into the elite pathway through that.
I mean, that was one of the defining moments of football for me last season, her disappearing at the end when they were trying to interview her, and she disappeared into the throng of other girls still with the microphone in her hand. Gareth, I can sense the frustration, the disappointment in your voice. Football at grassroots level relies on people like you, and it's losing people like you. I don't want to end an interview on this downbeat note. Is there anything you can tell me? Is there any optimistic note you can leave us on? Is there any good news to look forward to?
The good news is that if we step away from that top level, schools football at the actual grassroots level, at the schools level, is doing quite well.
Oh, great.
And I'm not just talking about locally, I'm talking about nationally. You know, the English Schools FA runs an annual campaign called Schools Football Week, and they got hundreds of thousands of kids playing during Schools Football Week. They are doing the best that they can. And, you know, we've got record numbers of girls teams playing in our cups. We've got, as I say, we've got 74 schools affiliated in Middlesex, which is the highest number it's been since I've got involved with the Schools FA. And we want to grow that. And so, yes, it's very sad that a part of football's history is under threat. But if you strip that back and you take it back to the real grassroots, that 12-year-old kid who gets called up for a school team for a county cup game because his PE teacher's spotted him in a lesson, then the picture's not so bleak.
Mm.
And that's why we're trying to be pragmatic and we are making tough decisions in Middlesex, so that we can give that 12-year-old boy, that 12-year-old girl, more opportunities to play, so that we can continue to fund the county round of the Pokemon Cup, which is something that the English Schools FA runs nationally for primary schools. It's, you know, the game in schools is not under threat per se. It needs help. It absolutely does. There needs to be a conversation nationally, collectively, about whether we want this tradition of representative football to continue. And if we do, how that is funded. Because the costs are eye-watering. As an example, it costs four times as much to enter the Middlesex under 14 boys into the ESFA National Cup than it would for Manchester City to enter the FA Challenge Cup. And that's something that needs to be looked at. But when you break it down and you get to the genuine grassroots, those kids playing for their school after school, and those teachers giving up their time, then there is still an ecosystem there. And I think it is in reasonable health. It does need more support. It does need more help. But it is not going away. There are still teachers willing to put teams out on the pitch on a Tuesday afternoon at 3:15. And that's precious. And long may that continue. The challenge that we have is on those Saturday mornings when we're trying to take a Middlesex team to Kent or Sussex or Surrey. And those challenges aren't unique to us. So we are focusing, we're trying to focus on the bigger picture and to protect the whole ecosystem of schools football rather than this one precious bit at the top of the pyramid.
That is a more optimistic note to finish on, Gareth. Thank you. And in fact, I can't think of a better note to finish on than the Pokemon Cup, which sounds fantastic, I have to say. Gareth, it's a pleasure talking to you. I can't imagine that you won't be involved in football shortly again at some level or another. So with any luck, we'll talk to you about that this time next year as well. All the best to you, mate.
Thanks, Kevin.
Kira, notwithstanding the economics, and again, for the sake of 8,000 quid, those kids could be having an experience that they'll enjoy for the rest of their life. It just proves how reliant football is at the grassroots level on those unpaid volunteers and teachers, doesn't it?
You're absolutely right. We spoke about some of the other people in football, and do they do it for love or money? Well, at this level, it is for love. It is for that egalitarian viewpoint of wanting to see young kids progress, to give them experiences which they wouldn't give elsewhere. And I think grassroots football in this country is one of our wonderful idiosyncrasies and strengths, and it has to be supported as much as we can. So that ties into the sort of the earlier discussion we had with regards to what might happen to Football Foundation money if the Premier League decides to say, well, if we're giving more money to the EFL, we can either take less money ourselves, or we could perhaps look at some of our other outgoings.
Yeah, speaking of grassroots, I probably should have mentioned earlier, I have tree pollen hay fever, which started for the first time this morning, which is yet another reason why I hate this time of year and everybody who likes it, basically. And on that cheery note, thank you to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. I'd like to thank Kieran Maguire for being mature enough not to mention Roy Hodgson, which was great because this is already a long pod. It would have been twice as long if he had done. In the meantime, I shall hand you over to the said Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
As always, thank you to everybody who supports us via Patreon. It's very kind, and we are hugely appreciative of it. There are a variety of ways in which you can support the show, and one of them is to go onto your app, which you use to download your podcasts, and to give us a review. It helps us in the charts. It helps us with the Apple algorithms. It gives us a bit more credibility when we are asking for guests. By all accounts, according to Producer Guy, it doesn't matter what you say. So you could even say you would rather have the show presented by Sepp Blatter and Brett Anderson of Suede, who gave a magnificent performance at Brighton Dome the other night, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to us.
Oh, yeah, I believe Sepp Blatter sent Roy Hodgson a tweet. Congratulate Dan. I thought I'd get through the whole pod without mentioning that. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.